way back in time.
Les mando mucho cariño. Yo soy Lila Downs. Está escuchando a CKLN 88.1 FM.
This is Michael Parenti, author of The Terrorism Trap and also The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. And I urge you to listen to Norman Richmond.
Pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope. Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
How about this?
Unlawful assent.
Please don't leave me alone. Oh.
He was born January 15, 1929. He was assassinated April 4, 1968 at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. He was just 39 years old. More than four decades after Dr. King's death, Barack Obama took his oath of office to become the 44th president of the United States and the first African-American president in U.S. history.
This is the meaning of our liberty and our creed, why men and women and children of every race and every faith can join in celebration across this magnificent mall, and why a man whose father less than 60 years ago might not have been served at a local restaurant can now stand before you to take a most sacred oath.
Obama accepted the Democratic Party nomination on the 45th anniversary of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners, will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream.
While Dr. King is primarily remembered as a civil rights leader, he also championed the cause of the poor and organized the Poor People's Campaign to address issues of economic justice. Dr. King was also a fierce critic of U.S. foreign policy and the Vietnam War. In his Beyond Vietnam speech, which he delivered at New York's Riverside Church on April 4, 1967, a year to the day before he was assassinated, Dr. King called the United States, quote, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Time magazine called the speech demagogic slander that sounded like a script for Radio Hanoi. The Washington Post said King, quote, diminished his usefulness to his cause, his country, his people. Today, we'll let you decide. We play an excerpt of Dr. King's speech, Beyond Vietnam.
So such thoughts take us beyond Vietnam, but not beyond our calling as sons of the living God. In 1957, a sensitive American official overseas said that it seemed to him that our nation was on the wrong side of a world revolution. During the past 10 years, we have seen emerge a pattern of suppression which has now justified the presence of U.S. military advisors in Venezuela, this need to maintain social stability for our investment, accounts for the counter-revolutionary action of American forces in Guatemala, it tells why American helicopters are being used against guerrillas in Cambodia, why American napalm and green beret forces have already been active against rebels in Peru. It is with such activity in mind that the words of the late John F. Kennedy come back to haunt us. 5 years ago, he said, those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. Increasingly, by choice or by accident, this is the role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolution impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that come from the immense profits of overseas investments. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered.
a true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. On the one hand, we are called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside. That will be only an initial act. One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be transformed so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. Justice and love, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift, is approaching spiritual death. These are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. And out of the wombs of a frail world, new systems of justice and barefoot people of the land are rising up as never before. People who sat in darkness have seen a great light. We in the West must support these revolutions. It is a sad fact that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, and our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. This has driven many to feel that only Marxism has a revolutionary spirit. Therefore, communism is a judgment against our failure to make democracy real and follow through on the revolutions that we initiate. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. This powerful commitment, we shall boldly challenge the status quo and unjust mode, thereby speed the day when every valley shall be exalted and every mountain and hill shall be made low.
Yes.
Crooked shall be made straight and the rough places plain. Mm-hmm. Genuine revolution of values means, in the final analysis, that our loyalties must become ecumenical rather than sectional. Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. This calls for a worldwide fellowship that lifts neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation. It is in reality a call for an all-embracing and unconditional love for all mankind. This oft misinterpreted concept, so readily dismissed by the Nietzsche's of the world as a weak and cowardly, has now become an absolute necessity for the survival of man. When I speak of love, I'm not speaking of some sentimental and weak response. I'm not speaking of that force which is just emotional bosh. I'm speaking of that force which all of the great religions have seen as the supreme unifying principle of life. Love is somehow the key that unlocks the door which leads to ultimate reality. This Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist belief about ultimate reality is beautifully summed up in the first epistle of St. John. Let us love one another.
Yes.
Love is God.
Yes.
And everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. We love one another. God dwelleth in us. His love is perfected in us. Let us hope that this spirit will become the order of the day. We can no longer afford to worship the God of hate, finger rights, and having writ moves on. We still have a choice today. Non-violent coexistence, a violent co-annihilation. We must move past indecision to action. We must find new ways to speak for peace in Vietnam and justice throughout the developing world, a world that borders on our doors. We do not act, we shall surely be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time, reserved for those who possess power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. This is the calling of the sons of God, and our brothers wait eagerly for our response. Shall we say the odds are too great? Shall we tell them the struggle is too hard? Will our message be that the forces of American life militate against our rival as poor men, and we send our deepest regrets? Will there be another message of longing, of hope, of solidarity with their yearnings, of commitment to their cause, whatever the cost? The choice is ours. And though we might prefer it otherwise, we must choose in this crucial moment of human history. That noble bard of yesterday, James Russell Lowell, eloquently stated, once to every man and nation comes a moment to decide in the strife of truth and falsehood for the good or evil side. Some great cause, God's new Messiah, offering each the bloom of light, and the choice goes by forever twixt that darkness. Though the cause of evil prosper, yet his truth alone is strong. Though her portion be the scaffold, and upon the throne be wrong, yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. If we will only make the right choice, we will be able to transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of peace. We will make the right choice. We will be able to transform the jangling discords of our world into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. We will but make the right choice. We will be able to speed up the day all over America and all over the world when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
Listening to CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto. My name is Shannon, and this is Plunder News each and every Saturday morning, or I should say Sunday morning, 8:30 to 9:30, broadcasting live to the FM wave band on 88.1 FM in Toronto. We're on Rogers Channel 947, and you can also catch us on the World Wide Web at ckln.fm. And now we're podcasting as well on radioforall.com. So check the podcast to be, let's say, ready for available download within 24 hours at radioforall.com. All right, good morning. We're just remembering there 44 years ago, April 4th, 1967, Martin Luther King at New York City Riverside Church, exactly 1 year before his death, delivered this famous speech, and actually one of his best speeches. Lots of parts that I sort of live every day. Anyway, Beyond Vietnam. From Martin. Okay, we're going to put a timeline on it. Headlines are reading things like this. 12 dead in small Afghanistan town. Angry mob rampages, killing UN peacekeepers and citizens. Root cause? A Koran burning in tiny Florida parish. Sort of your headline news there, which we'll jump through quick, finish that, and we're going to jump straight down to a brother of Martin Luther King, Dudley Laws. We're going to remember Dudley Laws, who passed on Thursday, March 24th, and was laid to rest this Saturday morning. And these are his last public words, written by Dudley himself, or by Dudley. May Dudley rest in peace. May 7th, 1934 to March 24th, 2011. The journey I have traveled over the past 76 years has brought me enormous knowledge and wisdom. The developing years of my childhood with my parents, siblings, and my extended family and community has instilled in me the precious value of honor and respect of human lives. Living in Jamaica the first 20 years of my life has taught me respect for my elders, beauty of nature, and the expectation of a better life and a more caring world. As I traveled to England in the late 50s and went through a transformation from a warm people and a climate to a cold and racist country, I was compelled to fight discrimination and racism. My 10 years of residing in England ended in 1965, the year I came to Canada. Those 44 years of living in Toronto, Canada, has caused me to be involved in many different struggles, including the criminal justice system, immigration, public housing, police, community relationships, racial profiling, and many other issues of concern to Afro-Canadian community and to society in general. One of the first lessons I learned that was very clear to me was that the community organized, and if the community hopes to achieve and sustain progress, justice, and respect. Because of this view and the historic philosophical teachings of the Honorable Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, Dr. Martin Luther King, and many others, I have joined and co-founded many organizations in England and Canada. The need for community-based organizations, national and international groups of cultural and political organizations, cannot be overstated. Soon after my arrival in Canada, I became a member of the Jamaican Canadian Association, of which I am still a member. Then I joined the Universal African Improvement Association, the Marcus Garvey Movement, and became its president in 1972. Some of the organizations that I co-founded were the Brixton Neighborhood Association, the Standing Committee of the West Indies in England, and the Black Youth and Community Action Project, BICAP, the Black Inmates and Friends Assembly, BIFA, and the Black Action Defense Committee, of which I am now its executive director in Canada, and various other committees that were formed in support of victims and their families due to police's use of deadly force. In continuation of my community involvement, I was always inspired by the teachings of the Honorable Marcus Garvey in his philosophy and personal opinions. He tells us, chance has never yet satisfied the hope of a suffering people. Action, self-reliance, and the vision of self and the future has been the only means by which the oppressed has seen and realized the hope of their own freedom. At the present time in Toronto and other parts of Canada, the African-Canadian community has extreme problems of internal acts of crime that has taken the lives of hundreds of young black men since the early 1990s. There is the problem of unemployment and underskilled youth, and there are the problems of young African-Canadian youth who are dropping out and being pushed out of the educational system. There are also the problems of and the condition of public housing. All of these issues are of urgent concern to most of us in the African-Canadian community. For many years, individuals and organizations have made enormous attempts in consulting with the three levels of government to address these problems in our community. These efforts have not been addressed, nor have they been achieved to a satisfactory degree. The failure of government to ban the manufacturing, sale, and distribution of guns has caused the unlimited usage of these deadly weapons in the African community, and the destabilization of hundreds of families, the deaths of hundreds of black youth, and the imprisonment of hundreds more. For many years, the Black Action Defense Community has been at the forefront of the struggle for the establishment of an independent civilian oversight to investigate police misconduct. And although the government has called many commissions or inquiries which have recommended the establishment of such a body, the government is reluctant to do so. It is my opinion that, and the opinion of others in and outside of our community, that if such a body is established, the citizens of Ontario and Canada have the means by which to make complaints on police abuse. This would greatly improve the relationship between the African-Canadian community and the police. Over the past few years, the provincial government has spent over $1 billion in building up super jails in Maplehurst and Penetanguishene, and the planning of a youth jail in Brampton. To my knowledge, the provincial government has not built a training center where young adults could be trained with the skill of gainful employment. The establishment of the Afrocentric School is a very positive advancement in the lives of some of our children, especially those who are unable to cope in the present school system. Some of our children need a more tender approach, a culturally sensitive place of acceptance and welcome that would develop the intelligence and genius in them. These 77 years have given me unlimited knowledge of my community and its people. Many persons living and deceased have given years of their lives for the betterment of our children and community. The continuation of this process is now the task of the growing youth leadership, in which I have tremendous confidence. My hope is that they will call upon the knowledge, experience, and wisdom of those of us who have traveled the path of leadership. In my visitations to the jails and prisons, I saw hundreds of young black men in these institutions and reflected on the various problems in our community. I must say that no child was born a criminal. It is the environment in which they grew that made them what they have become. All of us must therefore accept the responsibilities and work to change the acts of violence, poverty, unemployment, and economic dependency. Those of us who have gained reorganization have achieved honor because of the sacrifices men and women that have preceded us have made. We must now prepare our children to climb on our shoulders to the pinnacle of greatness that they must achieve. And those are pretty much the last words of Dudley Laws, who passed on March 24th, was buried yesterday. God rest his soul, and may we never forget his message, and that of Martin Luther King as well. All right, the next piece we're going to get into is from Charlie Veach, who was at the G20, was arrested earlier in the proceeding, Friday afternoon. One of the only people to be arrested under that Martial Law Act, that was a secret law, they call it. Anyway, yeah, he is in England now, and he's a blogger and a videographer. I'm just going to read this piece here from protests in London. Union leaders and police said more than 250,000 people joined the biggest demonstration in London since protests against the war in Iraq in 2003. The coalition in power since May is pushing ahead with tough debt reduction plan to virtually eliminate the budget deficit running about 10% of GDP by 2015. Many European countries have seen massive protests in recent months as governments slash public spending to try to help their economies recover from the global financial crisis. Union and opposition Labour Party says that the government is bringing misery to millions of Britons with unemployment at its highest level since 1994. The spending cuts are expected to result in more than 300,000 job losses in the public sector. And labor leader Ed Miliband goes on to say that this type of divisive politics has been absent from England since the 1980s in the Conservative Margaret Thatcher government. All right, so this piece is coming from a... Well, actually, it's coming from some other guys, but he's got Charlie Veach. You'll hear him here. And you're listening to Plunder News, 88.1 FM in Toronto. My name is Shannon.
Look at this, ladies and gentlemen. and gentlemen, this is trust and love in action. Heckler & Koch MP5 9mm submachine guns, probably Glock 9mm pistols, high voltage taser, electronic torture weapon, and a gigantic iron fence. That is trust in action. Ladies and gentlemen, because of something called the internet, information has traveled around the world instantly. And the people don't take it anymore. It's not just revolutionaries, it's not just anarchists, it's everyone! Hey! Realizes that enough is enough. Ladies and gentlemen, please do some research into what central banks are, into where money comes from, into what interest is, into what the European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, they invent money out of thin air. Yet because they gave their banking friends and their Rothschild yachts some money, you guys, including the police, will have to tighten your belts a little bit, lose your jobs, not pay your mortgages, not be able to send your children to university unless you pay £9,000 a year. But it's okay. We've got enough money to bomb Libya. But just like in Egypt, just like in Tunisia, things will change. And this illegitimate, scumbag, lying, murdering government will be brought down. And anyway, just so you all know, I'm a little bit extreme. I'm a complete philosophical and political anarchist. Which means that no one has any authority over you. Not the government, not the police, not even yourself. No one's got any authority. Do you know what I love about police uniform? It's the dehumanizing aspect, how you guys all look identical. Every single one of you. Slave, 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 slave.
All right, we're back. 9/11 down here at CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto. My name is Shannon. This is Plunder News. Just heard a piece from the Love Police Action in London, England on March 26th, I believe. Yeah. The other week, 250,000 people out in London, England protesting the austerity measures in place in London, England, courtesy of a coalition government. A bizarre, actually, coalition government, but we won't get into that. All right, we're going to jump into got an interesting debate off of the Democracy Now! Site. And actually, that's going to pretty much take us out of here. I'm going to try to read this little piece here from John Spears, business reporter out of the Toronto Star, regarding, critics slam OPG plans for Darlington nuclear reactors. The proposal by the Ontario Public Generation, Power Generation, there it is, the proposal fails to avert or justify environmental damage, the panel was told. The panel in Curtis, Ontario, that is winding up this week coming. Ontario Power Generation shouldn't be granted a license to start work on a new nuclear reactor at Darlington because it hasn't shown how it will mitigate damage to the environment, a panel probing the reactors has been told. It's clear that OPG's application should not be approved, said Mark Matheson, president of the Ontario Lake Waterkeeper, told the panel. There will be adverse effects. OPG has not made appropriate efforts to mitigate these effects, and OPG has not justified these effects. In an hour presentation to the review panel, the group said that the project hasn't properly considered alternatives to plant cooling. Plans call for sucking water into the plant from Lake Ontario and then returning it. It kills fish, according to Madison. The plan doesn't address the fact that the site is next door to a gravel quarry. Blasting shakes the ground, and quarrying can lower the water table underground, causing land in the surrounding area to become unstable and sink. Local atmospheric conditions may trap emissions from the plant and keep them from dispersing over a wide area. The joint panel of the Canadian Nuclear Safety Association and the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency has the power to grant a license to start preparing the site for a new plant. Wilf Rutland, a hydrologist hired by Waterkeeper, said that he had expected OPG to produce a Cadillac environment plan. But that's not what I found, he said. The environmental assessment that's been done simply is not adequate for a project of this magnitude. He said the assessment assumes specific plans to minimize environmental damage will be developed. These plans don't exist yet, but the assumption is that these different plans that have yet to be developed are going to be perfectly effective, he said. Madison attacked OPG for planning to cool the new plant by cycling lake water through it, instead of building a closed-loop system with cooling towers, which continuously recycle the same water through the plant, cooling it in towers before pumping it through again. The towers would be visible from Highway 401. OPG has suggested it would prefer to kill fish than to have a visual reminder of nuclear power by the 401, Madison said. Ian Fairley, a consultant of a Peterborough-based environmental group, Safe and Green Energy, attacked the proposed plan for failing to consider radiation impacts within 5 to 10 kilometers of the plant. He cited a German study of 16 reactors and showed the incidence of infant leukemia was 120% close to the plants. The panel also heard that from federal fisheries official Tom Hogarth that the Darlington nuclear plant is not in compliance with federal fishery laws that prohibit killing fish and end damaging habitat. So the inquiry continues this week in Cordis, and we're going to jump right now to a little debate, a very interesting debate between two types of environmentalists. One guy is a global warming kind of advocate, I believe, and he's fighting the sort of anti-coal burning side of things. And then you have Dr. Helen Caldicott, who is on the anti-nuclear side. So these two environmentalists are having a little debate. Actually, George Manboit is the name of the environmentalist on the anti-coal side. So he's so concerned about being an anti-coal guy that the nuclear energy is okay with him. So they have a little debate here. We're going to run just a piece of it. It's 7 minutes have already been cut off, so we'll catch the last 10 minutes of that, and then we'll be back on 88.1 FM CKLN. Plunder News. My name is Shannon.
Renewing the whole nuclear power debate by providing the loan guarantees that would allow for new plants to be built for the first time in more than 30 years. Helen Caldicott, are you concerned about this?
Oh, Amy, the whole thing's nuclear madness, which is what I called my first book that I wrote in 1978. A new report from the New York Academy of Sciences has just translated 5,000 papers from Russian into English. It's the most devastating report I've ever seen. Up to 1 million people have already died from Chernobyl, and people will continue to die from cancer for virtually the rest of time. What we should know is that 1/1,000th of a gram of plutonium or less can induce cancer, or will induce cancer. Each reactor has 250 kilos or 500 pounds of plutonium in it. There's enough plutonium in these reactors to kill everyone on Earth. Now, what George doesn't understand, and that, George, I really appreciate your writing, and I understand your concern about global warming. You was commissioned to write an article for the New England Journal of Medicine about the dangers of nuclear power. I spent a year researching it. You've bought the propaganda from the nuclear industry. They say it's low-level radiation. That's absolute rubbish. If you inhale a millionth of a gram of plutonium, the surrounding cells receive a very, very high dose. Most die within that area because it's an alpha emitter. The cells on the periphery remain viable They mutate and their regulatory genes are damaged. Years later, that person develops cancer. Now, that's true for radioactive iodine that goes to the thyroid, cesium-137 that goes to the brain and muscles, strontium-90 goes to bone, causing bone cancer and leukemia. It's imperative, George, because you're highly intelligent and a very important commentator, that you understand internal emitters and radiation, and it's not low level to the cells that are exposed. Radiobiology is imperative to understand these days. I do suggest humbly that if you read my book, Nuclear Power's Not the Answer, which I think I've tried to send you once, you'll learn about that. And I totally agree, global warming is a terrible, terrible catastrophe. However, I commissioned a study done by Arjun Makajani from IEER about 3-4 years ago called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free. The truth is, George, that there's enough renewable technology now, right now, which is relatively cheap, to supply the whole of the US's needs by 2040 without any carbon and any nuclear. We just need to have the politicians get out, out of the pockets of the nuclear companies, the coal companies, the oil companies, and start funding renewable energy. Why isn't there a solar panel on every single house in America? Solar hot water systems, windmills everywhere. You know, it would increase the GDP and employ hundreds of thousands of people throughout the world. This is the way to go. That's the prescription for survival. Nuclear power, George, creates massive quantities of radioactive waste. There's no one where to put it on Earth that's safe. As it leaks into the water over time, it will bioconcentrate in the food chains, in the breast milk, in the fetuses that are thousands of times more radiosensitive than adults. One X-ray to the pregnant abdomen doubles the incidence of leukemia in the child. And over time, nuclear waste will induce epidemics of cancer, leukemia, and genetic disease, and random compulsory genetic engineering. And we're not the only species with genes, of course, it's plants and animals. So this is an absolute catastrophe, the likes of which the world has never seen
before.
Let's
get George Monbiot's response.
Yes, well, thank you, Helen, and thank you for all the work you've done over the years, which I think has made a fantastic contribution. But what you were saying about the impacts of radiation does not seem to square with the observed cancer rates amongst populations who have been
exposed to
higher levels
of
radiation.
Right. Sorry, George.
When I've been dealing with climate change over the past 20 years or so, I learned very quickly that you have to effectively go with the scientific consensus rather than with a few outlier papers, because to choose those outlier papers over the scientific consensus is effectively to cherry pick or to data mine and to get what turns out to be a misleading view. That's certainly been my experience with climate change. Now, when it comes to radiation, I think we're in danger possibly of falling into a similar trap to the trap that climate change deniers have fallen into with their cherry picking of the science there. For instance, I don't think you could dismiss the UN Scientific Committee as being part of the nuclear industry. I don't think you can dismiss the very large amount of data on the... you're saying you would dismiss the UN Scientific Committee as being part of the nuclear industry?
Yes, let me tell you, George.
Wow.
I'll tell you why in a minute.
But I mean, if that is the case, then it worries me. The UN Scientific Committee on Atomic Radiation. It worries me if you really do lump them in there, that we're getting into the same sort of conspiratorial thinking that you have with climate change denial, whereby anyone who doesn't go along with the line of the climate change deniers that carbon dioxide is not connected with climate change, for example, is in the hands of the carbon trading industry or something like that. Now, you know, there is a very large body of evidence from Chernobyl, from many other nuclear incidents, from people's exposure to elevated levels of background radiation, whether it's radon gas coming from granite masses, whether it's higher solar radiation because of where they live. And what we do not see is a clear relationship between those lower levels of radiation that you predict and the incidence of cancers, let alone the higher incidence of death. It's just, it's only there in very particular cases, generally with extremely high exposures of radiation, or in specific cases like, for instance, the combination of radon exposure and smoking, which raises the incidence of lung cancer among smokers from 10% to 16%. But the radon exposure seems to have almost no impact on the level of cancers among the rest of the population. So I just think, you know, we've got to be very, very careful about which science we trust and which we do not.
George, there's a huge literature on internal emitters and radiation. The New York Academy of Science, this report on Chernobyl is absolutely devastating. But there are now 2,600 genetic diseases described. I first learned about radiation by learning experiments with Drosophila fruit fly by Muller when I did first year medicine in 56. You can produce a gene for a crooked wing that's passed on generation to generation. We will not live to see the abnormalities created by radiation from our activities now, because, you know, we'll all be dead by the time we have 20 or more generations. But it's imperative that people understand that internal emitters cause cancer, but the incubation time for cancer is any time from 2 to 60 years. George, the International Atomic Energy Agency has an unholy alliance with the WHO, World Health Organization, which says WHO cannot examine any accident related to nuclear power, etc., without the permission of the IAEA. And indeed, it didn't examine Chernobyl. 40% of the European landmass is still radioactive, George. Turkish food is extremely radioactive. And we have to wait to see the cancers arising and do epidemiological studies, many of which have been done to expose populations. George, there's no debate about this. There's no debate. I speak to doctors all the time in medical schools, in hospitals, grand rounds. We all understand this. There is no debate in the medical community.
Well, let me ask George Monbiot. The 25th anniversary of Chernobyl is 3 weeks away. Scientists have documented extreme levels of radiation still there, miles and miles of dead trees, mutated birds, insects, leukemia deaths of children. Is this your understanding?
Miles and miles of dead trees. I don't believe that that's an effect of Chernobyl. It might well be an effect of acid rain in the area, but I haven't seen any scientific evidence suggesting miles and miles of dead trees caused by the Chernobyl erosion or of widespread impacts amongst wildlife. Now, as for the leukemia incidents, yes, unquestionably. Well, thyroid cancer actually was the big one amongst children. There was some elevated incidence of leukemia amongst particularly a few of the workers at Chernobyl, but the broader impact was of thyroid cancer, and that could have been massively reduced, that incidence, A, by giving iodine pills to children, and B, by forbidding them for a period of time from drinking the contaminated milk. Because the authorities were so appallingly lax and didn't do any of either of those basic precautions, we see a much higher rate of thyroid cancer amongst children than there ever should have been. Now, on these questions that Helen raises, I mean, if she's honestly saying that the World Health Organization is now part of the conspiracy and the cover-up as well, then the mind boggles. Where does this end?
Boggle.
Them and the UN Scientific Committee and the IAEA and, I mean, who else is involved in this conspiracy? We need to know.
Finally,
Helen
Caldicott.
Yes, we do. It's the IAEA which promotes nuclear power. Oh, sorry, Amy. It's the IAEA that promotes nuclear power, right, but says you mustn't build bombs from your reactor. And that negotiation took place, several decades, quite a lot of decades ago. And the WHO just does not. It has not examined the results, yes. This is the biggest medical conspiracy and cover-up in the history of medicine, George. Yes.
So the WHO, IAEA, the UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation.
I don't know about the UN.
Sorry about that. I'm going to have to cut that one right there. Just another minute left in the debate. You can catch that at Democracy Now. I believe that's March 27th. No, March 30th is the day on the website, Democracy Now. You can catch the rest of that debate. Hopefully you can. Nice and loud, eh? All right, we're going to sign off. Just check out the this show will be posted at radioforall.net, possibly YouTube within the next 24 hours. You can contact me at Plunder News. You can contact me at plundernewsbell.net. And with the sources today were for the Beyond Vietnam speech was from Martin Luther King Online. We heard La Rue in the Kill, various dubstep remixes, Democracy Now, March 30th, George Manabot and Dr. Helen Caldicott having a debate. The Dudley Laws Obit. And LPA London, LONDYN, off the YouTube. Also read article from John Spears, Critics Slam OPG for the Darlington Nuclear Reactors. All right. That's it for Plunder News on CKLN 88.1 FM. In the Red is ready now.